Good morning.
Good morning
and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. As always, I encourage you, if you are fairly new to the congregation, to come back more than one time because our services are different on different Sunday mornings. They are done either by myself, Sandy, part-time minister here, by someone outside the fellowship, or by leaders within the congregation. And of course, everyone is welcome, no matter where you are on your spiritual journey. These, then, are the opening words. Spirit of life and renewal, we have wintered enough, mourned enough, oppressed ourselves enough. Our souls are too long cold and buried, our dreams all but forgotten. Our hopes unheard. We are waiting to rise from the dead. In this, the season of steady rebirth, we awaken to the power so abundant, so holy, that returns each year through earth and sky. We will find our hearts again and our good spirits. We will love and believe and give and wonder and feel again the eternal powers. The flow of life moves ever onward through one faithful spring and another, and now we hope another. May we be forever grateful. Hallelujah. Amen. Now I would like to invite the Evan Creed and Johanna Hatch and Liam up to do our chalice lighting.
For every time we make a mistake and we decide to start again, we light this chalice. For every time we are lonely and we let someone be our friend, we light this chalice. For every time we are disappointed and we choose to hope, we light this, our chalice.
Thank you. Thank you, Liam. The reading that I want to share with you this morning is by Unitarian Universalist minister David Blanchard, titled The Art of Forgiveness. He writes, "Forgiveness is a somewhat reckless, typically illogical act, a leap of faith, if you will. When Jesus preached forgiveness, people thought he was insane. Loving your neighbor is one thing, but your enemies too. When struck on one cheek, offer the other. If someone takes your coat, give your cloak as well. We may think it was easy for Jesus to say this, his father being God and all, but what about those of us who live in the real world? Do we have to do it too? I suppose it depends on what we want from life. Forgiveness in the world is still a bit reckless and illogical, but so is love, having children, or creating anything that we are willing to give away. But we do these things all the time, and we trust that because we have done them, we will be more fulfilled, more connected, more present to the joys and wonders of the world. The alternative is to be satisfied with dismal little corroded existences. But most of the time, we rarely make a conscious choice between the two. It is through forgiveness that we can discover the freedom it takes to place ourselves in right relation to the divine, with those we love and care about, and with ourselves. And I will interrupt Blanchard's writing here to say that being in right relationship is atonement, I know we don't like that word, but it's a wonderful word. Take it apart. At one mat. Blanchard says it may not be logical, but forgiveness, clear and unconditional, frees the forgiver more deeply than the person being forgiven. Chances are good they didn't even know they had done something that required forgiving. It's a bold and constructive step based in a sense of faith that forgiveness withheld is a poison to the soul. When we hold back forgiveness, we repeat over and over our hurt, reassuring ourselves of our indignation. Some people live their lives off that pain. It's not required. Real power and authentic freedom come with what is so hard to do: forgive. In the end, those who have found a way to forgive know that the most profound work of forgiveness is done not for those who want it, but for the sake of mending our own soul and for the freedom we find when we recklessly squander our forgiveness. Do we have to do it? Practice the art of forgiveness, that is, asks Blanchard. Do we have to do it too? I suppose it depends on what we want from life, he answers. Well, I have been practicing this art of forgiveness concept. No, I should say I've been trying to practice it during the past several days, not always successfully. But I am finding that there is indeed an amazing potential for freedom in being a practitioner of the art. It's all over the news. Forgiveness, that is. Perhaps you've noticed? Consider these news items just from the past few days. Armenian orphan rug may go on view. Do you know about the Armenian orphan rug? You probably do know that 1.5 million Armenians were killed by the Turks in a genocide that the Turks still refuse to call that a genocide. This 12 by 18 rug was first presented to President Calvin Coolidge in 1925, and it depicts the orphans of this genocide. We were going to put it on display in this country at the Smithsonian just a few years ago, but the Turks protested. And now there's a possibility that it might be on display again at the Smithsonian. Piles and piles of bodies left after South Sudan slaughter. This from April 23rd newspaper. You probably heard about this, although it's certainly not getting much attention in this country. The people who went into a mosque thought they would be safe there, but they were slaughtered instead. And then there is the Nevada Rancher Apologizes headline from April 26th after his racist remarks that blacks were better off as slaves, said Cliven Bundy. And then a few days later he said, I hope I didn't offend anybody. If I did, I ask for your forgiveness. On April 28th, there was this, secret war deaths, said the headline. How many of you know what Slapton Sands is? Well, having had a dad who participated in D-Day, I have been to Slapton Sands in England. On April 28th, 70 years ago, 749 Allied soldiers, mostly Americans, were killed at right off the coast at Slapton Sands in a practice exercise for D-Day. This was April, 2 months before, 6 weeks before D-Day, and it was covered up until very recently because Roosevelt and others were worried about the morale. I would say rightly worried about the morale on our troops. And then there are the reviews of a new movie, The Railway Man. Consider, I'll talk about that in just a moment. But consider all of that. In addition to the fact that Holocaust Remembrance Day, Yom HaShoah, that day began at sundown on April 27th and ended the evening of Monday, April 28th. Holocaust Remembrance Week, about which I heard nothing this year. In other years, I have. It began on April 27th, and it ends today, May 4th. It's all over the news, this thing about forgiveness. Forgiveness can, I think, be divided somewhat arbitrarily into at least three categories: the mundane, the murky, and the miraculous. At the mundane level would be those many thoughtless actions that we all commit, the actions that cause harm to ourselves and to others. The operative word here, of course, is thoughtless. We don't mean to harm anyone or hurt people's feelings or neglect to take care of ourselves. And how we treat ourselves and our precious, precious bodies and minds is a crucial component of the art of forgiveness. Harriet Harris, in our story this morning, and her mother were engaged in forgiveness of the mundane category. At least Harriet was, because everyday occasions for forgiveness are commonplace for children, aren't they? We learn quickly when we are youngsters that there are many times when we are expected to say, "I'm sorry." Perhaps we are not quite aware of what those two words mean when we first begin to utter them. I would call this a primitive form of asking for forgiveness. We don't yet completely understand the complexity contained in those two simple words, "I'm sorry." Sometimes I go through several days of seeming to have foot-in-mouth disease. I say things that I should not have said. I speak without thinking. And the so-called modern ways in which we communicate do not help. Take email, for example. You hit that send button without practicing Buddhist attentiveness to your message, and you can be in deep doo-dah. I have a 24-hour rule for myself, wherein I try not to respond to messages that push my buttons or irritate me until 24 hours have passed. This does not apply in emergency situations or when someone seems to be in crisis. I occasionally forget that I have this rule. I believe that Quakers practice something similar with speaking. They supposedly wait 20 seconds or 30 seconds. A certain amount of this behavior is fairly normal, I think, given the frenetic way in which we live now. We're all so busy and we're very, very distracted. Almost everyone whom I have ever known has been guilty of speaking without thinking. For these times, we need to ask to be forgiven. Just as importantly, we need to forgive others if we have been the recipient of harsh, thoughtless words, or if our faults have been pointed out to us in a less than gracious manner, even though we might be in need of some constructive criticism. Part of the art of forgiveness, I think, is to know when we are in a relatively mundane, frequently occurring situation, and when we have moved into a murkier area. I would probably place some of those news stories I just cited in this category, mainly because of how long ago they happened. For example, the Slapton Sands incident 70 years ago and the Armenian controversy. I say this because most or all of the people involved are dead. And who is left to give forgiveness? Who is asking for it? But on the other hand, thinking this way misses an important point. Some of you are familiar with the doctrines of discovery, and this is a very good example. Those were the edicts that the popes proclaimed in the 1400s, 1500s, for the people sailing to this country and other new worlds. I'm paraphrasing greatly, that essentially this was for the white people, whatever was discovered here, no matter who lived here. And there are many petitions that have now been taken to the Vatican, including one by the Unitarian Universalist Association, asking the Pope to
take it back, to recant. Now, I really don't think this is going to happen. Probably trying to repeal them won't work, but I think it is necessary to acknowledge the existence of the doctrines of discovery and to repudiate them. And with Pope Francis, who knows? As I seriously began to contemplate the art of forgiveness, I had to face up to my own limitations in this area. I have relegated too many things that need my forgiveness to this gray, murky level. I need to retrieve those issues and look them squarely in the face and, as they say, deal with it. At that regional meeting in Wausau 3 weeks ago, I reconnected with people from Green Bay and Ripon, where I had once been the minister. And at least one of these people with whom I reconnected had been, shall we say, less than kind to me. And yet here we were, chatting, as if we were old dear friends, chatting about way bigger things than those disagreements we had had with each other almost 5 years ago. Now we were talking about life and death, because of course people in those congregations had died or were not doing well. We talked about the health of the Unitarian Universalist Association. We talked about the new regional way of organizing ourselves. We talked about the stability of our congregations. All of this trumped the disagreements we had had years ago about the budget, or how to implement policies and procedures, or styles of leadership. I wrestle with how to forgive my dad. His treatment of me in the 6 months or so before he died was harsh and puzzling. Most of the time, I'm angry with him. That sort of gets in the way of forgiving. Yet, that seems not only pointless, but silly. Why be angry at and unforgiving of someone close to me, someone who is no longer here, though? I've been stuck in that murky, middle-level, gray area of forgiveness. I am equally stuck in a struggle to forgive the addiction of someone close to me who can't or won't see what she is doing to herself and could potentially do to others if she continues to drink and drive. Anger is present here, too, interwoven with my desire to forgive her. A little side note here. We could and probably should do an entire service about alcoholism and addictions. I mention it now because I suspect many people struggle with how to forgive those near and dear to themselves who are caught in addictions. Considering the mundane level of forgiveness and the murky level of forgiveness brings me to the miraculous level of forgiveness. There are more examples of this than you might think. I have mentioned before the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa and the many, many astounding stories from that commission of victims meeting their oppressors, sitting face to face with those who tortured them. Rwanda has done some significant work in this area, and so has Northern Ireland. And by the way, April marked the 20th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda that killed an estimated 1 million people. I saw the railway man a few days ago. I considered it to be homework. It's a movie about, well, I don't know how many of you know about it. I don't want to spoil it. It's about a prisoner of war. It's a true story. He was in the Pacific Theater, Eric Lomax. He was in Thailand and captured, and a bridge was being built by those captured and by native peoples who were conquered by the Japanese there for a while. Okay, spoiler alert. I'll just say that he failed to do something that a part of you, if you see this movie, might wish he would do. And this isn't too much of a spoiler alert, maybe, but finally Lomax, the man who, from England actually, says, "I will never forget what you did to me," because he meets the man who tortured him. He goes back and meets him. This was just not too many years ago. He says, "I will never forget what you did to me, but I do completely forgive you." It's a pretty graphic movie, so be prepared. I knew when I was thinking about forgiveness that I would have to return to one of the most powerful books I have ever read, The Sunflower, on the possibilities and limits of forgiveness by Simone Wiesenthal. Some of you may know that name. Some of you would probably say Simon Wiesenthal, but that wouldn't be the correct pronunciation. Wiesenthal was born in 1908. He spent the years from 1941 until 1945 in concentration camps. He became known as the Nazi hunter. He chaired a commission after the war to find people who had committed atrocities and bring them to justice. And boy, I forget how many. He was very successful. He didn't die until 2005. He was 97. Has anybody read The Sunflower? It's not a very long book, but it's a very intense book. Two parts. In the first part of The Sunflower, Wiesenthal tells us a story. It's a true story. It happened to him in 42-43. He was a prisoner, and he was strong enough to still do labor. So he's marching in a line of prisoners one day, and they're going into a town in Russia to do, was it Poland? Somewhere over there, to do work, and they have a relatively easy job this day. They're in a hospital yard in the outside of a big hospital. A building that's being used as a hospital. It turns out that this was a technical school, and Wiesenthal actually went to the school before the war. He was an architect. So all of a sudden, someone comes up to a Nazi soldier comes up to him, singles him out, and says, "Come with me." And that soldier is accompanied by a nurse. So he doesn't know what's going on. The nurse takes him into this makeshift hospital, takes him into a small room where there is a dying Nazi soldier. The soldier does not know Wiesenthal. Wiesenthal does not know the soldier. He apparently wants to be forgiven for anything he might have done. We don't know all of what he did, but we know one thing that he did, because he tells Wiesenthal what he did. There was a town that they had entered, the Germans, and Russians had just left, but the Russians sabotaged things, of course, to have them blow up and kill German soldiers. So the SS, and you always have to remember, the SS is not your ordinary German soldier, but the SS herded about 250 to 300 Jews, mostly children and women and older people, into a three-story house. You would not think that many people would fit in a three-story house, but they did. And they then poured petrol all over, and they locked the doors, and they threw hand grenades in. Well, of course, some people tried to escape out the windows. And in particular, the dying Nazi soldier said to Wiesenthal that he cannot get the image of a young couple out of his mind, and the father holding the little boy and covering the little boy's eyes, and then they jump out the window, and then the dying Nazi soldier shot them before he was dying. And he shot many people, and they all did, but he can't get this particular family out of his mind. Well, imagine this. He himself is ill, and he'd been in concentration camps at this point for a couple of years, and he'd been doing hard labor, and he doesn't have enough to eat, and he's thinking, why? Is this, why me? Why did this man bring me in here? And he doesn't say a word. He does not give him any kind of absolution. He does not forgive him. He says nothing. And he leaves, and then a couple days later, they go back to the same place. The nun, the nurse, who is also a nun, comes along and says, "Come with me." And he thinks, "Oh, no, you're not again." Well, the man had died. The Nazi soldier had died. But he had given the nurse, the nun, a package. It's a tiny package of the soldier's things. And the soldier wanted Wiesenthal to have these things. And he said, "No. No." And this all happened. It's a very weird story. He said, I can't. But he does notice the address on the package, which is important to the next part of the story. It's the address of the soldier's mother. War ends, Wiesenthal survives, and he remembers the address. He goes to Stuttgart, is where the mother lived. Town's destroyed, but he manages to find the mother. And because he just can't let go of this, did he do the right thing? Should he have said something to this dying soldier? Just can't let that go. So he goes to see the mother. He's not sure why, but maybe to find out a little bit more about the soldier, because the soldier had told him that he was raised a good Catholic, that his parents did not want him to join the Hitler Youth. The parents were opposed to the Nazis. So he finds the mother, and he cannot bring himself to tell her what the son had done, the terrible things he had done. And she keeps saying he was a good boy, and Wiesenthal doesn't correct her. In the second part of the book, Wiesenthal asks others what they would have done had they been the one in the room with a dying Nazi soldier. He, Wiesenthal, asked for and received responses from theologians, political leaders, writers, psychiatrists, human rights activists, Holocaust survivors, victims of attempted genocides in Bosnia, Cambodia, China, and Tibet, among other people. These people who responded were Buddhists, Christians, Muslims, humanists, agnostics, atheists. And I'll give you a couple of their responses in just a moment. There were some broad areas of consensus among the responders. There was a consensus that forgiving and forgetting don't go together, despite the widespread use of the phrase, we all know you have to forgive and forget. It is not always possible to forget, especially in such extreme circumstances. There was general agreement, and I think you'd find this in most of the major religions of the world, that we don't forgive others, this is what Blanchard was saying, primarily to help them, but we do it to help ourselves, to move on, hopefully. Otherwise, we become frozen. There's one more aspect of forgiveness that I need to mention this morning before I end my remarks. My thoughts about forgiveness kept coming back to the need all of us have to be forgiven by the universe for what we are doing and have done to the earth. If you haven't figured it out by now, I am a seventh principle Unitarian Universalist minister. There is actually a group of us, and you all know what the seventh principle is, I hope. It's the beginning of the hymn book if you need to check. It's that interdependent web thing. But I had to seriously review this proclamation of mine after listening to Matt Tedesco do his presentation last Sunday. Not inherent worth, but what's that word I'm looking for? The intrinsic. Yeah. What about those stones? What about? I had to think about that. But here in this area, I think I feel I need the highest form of forgiveness, the miraculous kind of forgiveness. But who's going to give that to me? And why should the universe forgive me for my transgressions against Mother Earth? I try to keep my carbon footprint light. I bike, I walk, I seldom use a dryer, I have a pretty fuel-efficient car, I don't turn up the heat too far, except for the last few days when I couldn't stand it any longer. But then every time I get onto an airplane, I blow all of that, don't I?
Yeah.
No forgiveness from this group. And for me, it isn't just what we do to Mother Earth that leaves me in need of the miraculous level of forgiveness. It is what is happening to the other peoples on Mother Earth while we do nothing. The South Sudan being an excellent example, but so is Syria and Tibet and Nigeria. And there's no end to the examples of brokenness that I want to do something about, but I can't. And I want to be forgiven for my helplessness, my seeming indifference. I understand this poem of Mary Oliver's titled The Morning Paper. Read one newspaper daily. The morning edition is the best, for by evening you know that you at least have lived through another day. And let the disasters, the unbelievable yet approved decisions, soak in. I don't need to name the countries, ours among them. What keeps us from falling down, our faces to the ground, ashamed? Ashamed. I'm not going to leave us here. I can't. I have to believe that there is more to the art of forgiveness than ending up in despair or being ashamed. Not that we won't pass through despair and shamefulness on our way to true forgiveness. The title of my reflections is missing two sentences. Years ago, I ran across a quote from some famous person, or not, it doesn't matter, about the four most important sentences in the English languages, in English language, and wanting these spoken at this person's memorial service. I can't find the quote, and no, I did not Google it. Not yet, anyway. I like to have a little mystery in my life. The four sentences, possibly paraphrased, are, I forgive you. Please forgive me. I love you. Please love me. Which brings me back to those who responded to Simon Wiesenthal's experience and his question, what would you do? Robert McAfee Brown responded. He was then Professor Emeritus of Theology and Ethics at the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, where I took several classes. McAfee Brown says, what is there left for us to do? Only everything, from doing justly, loving kindness, and walking humbly with God, or if you all prefer, with the universe, with the spirit of all that is, to standing with the victims and the oppressed. That's what we do. That's what we gather here to do, to stand with the victims and the oppressed. McAfee Brown continues, and if we do so, perhaps, just perhaps, a world will begin to emerge in which we do not have to ask unanswerable questions any longer. And then this from the Dalai Lama. I believe one should forgive the person or persons who have committed atrocities against oneself and humankind. But this does not necessarily mean one should forget about the atrocities committed. In fact, one should be aware and remember these experiences so that efforts can be made to check the reoccurrence of such atrocities in the future. He says, I find such an attitude especially helpful in dealing with the Chinese government's stand on the Tibetan people's struggle to regain freedom. Since China's invasion of Tibet in 1949 and 50, more than 1.2 million Tibetans, one-fifth of the country's population, have lost their lives due to massacre, execution, starvation, and suicide. Yet for more than four decades, we have struggled to keep our cause alive and preserve our Buddhist culture of nonviolence and compassion. It would be easy to become angry at these tragic events and atrocities. Labeling the Chinese as our enemies, we could self-righteously condemn them for their brutality and dismiss them as unworthy of further thought or consideration. But that is not the Buddhist way. Here I would like to relate a very interesting incident, the Dalai Lama says. A few years back, a Tibetan monk who had served about 18 years in a Chinese prison in Tibet came to see me after his escape to India. I knew him from my days in Tibet and remember last seeing him in 1959. During the course of that meeting, I had asked him what he felt was the biggest threat or danger while he was in prison. I was amazed by his answer. It was extraordinary and inspiring. I was expecting him to say something else. Instead, he said that what he most feared was losing his compassion for the Chinese. Well, for most of us, having not lived through traumatic, dramatic events, we must first forgive ourselves. And this isn't a very elegant analogy, but it's the only one I could come up with. The freedom that comes with the act of forgiveness reminds me of what happens when a clogged drain is unclogged. A lot of exasperation and frustration disappears. It is that mundane. It is that serious. To be able to say, yes, we did this, whether in the mundane, murky, or miraculous category, we did this. Whether we are talking to ourselves or to someone else or to the universe, we cannot undo it. We forgive. Now what? To be able to say these things clears the path and the mind and the soul so we can move forward and continue the work of mending a broken world. I forgive you. Please forgive me. I love you. Please love me. May we daily forgive ourselves and each other and begin each day again in love. These are the closing words. They're rather intriguing, I think. Forgive us that often we forgive ourselves so easily and others so hardly. Forgive us that we expect perfection from those to whom we show none. Forgive us for repelling people by the way we set a good example. Forgive us the folly of trying to improve a friend. Forbid that we should use our little idea of goodness as a spear to wound those who are different. Forbid that we should feel superior to others when we are only more shielded. And may we encourage the secret struggle of every person. Go in peace and do some forgiving.